This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your daily voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, here's your host, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Welcome to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I'm not Tony Perkins. My name is Peter Sprigg, a senior fellow here at Family Research Council, filling in along with my colleague.
I'm Chris Gasek from Family Research Council also.
And we are filling in for Tony this afternoon because Tony happens to be in Las Vegas. No, he's not playing the slots at the casinos. At least we hope not.
He's not there to visit the Hoover Dam.
Right. He's there because of a big event that's happening tonight, the final presidential debate of this 2016 presidential election campaign between Republican Donald Trump and Democrat Hillary Clinton. And Tony will be there for the debate tonight. So we're going to talk to Tony right now and get his view on what he expects to take place in Las Vegas. Tony, welcome back to your show, Washington Watch.
Hey, Peter, Chris, great to be with you. How's everything back in D.C.?
Well, very warm, actually, today, but you sound great. You're terrific phone connection here.
Yeah, so a big event, a big night there in Las Vegas, and there's lots of things going on the campaign trail and behind the scenes. What should we look forward to tonight in the debate in Las Vegas?
Well, Peter, you're absolutely right. The stakes could not be higher, and I'm not talking about Harrod's Casino. I'm talking about the debate between Hillary and Donald. Final debate of three debates, and the national polling, depending on what you look at, basically shows them tied or within a statistical dead heat. Although some of the swing states shows that Hillary Clinton has a bit of a lead. One of the questions that has been raised is whether or not there is this underpolling by the Trump campaign just because of the marginalization that has taken place by the mainstream media of Trump and his supporters. So anyway, tonight's debate probably is going to cover a broader range of issues. I was speaking to members of the Trump campaign today. They're prepared to talk about issues like the court, the Supreme Court. And I think what has to happen, and this is, earlier I was on Neil Cavuto's show. I'm going to be on with Lou Dobbs before the debate, and it'll be talking to reporters after the debate. I think what has to happen tonight for Donald Trump probably to break away from Hillary Clinton, reestablish some type of lead, is that, look, the character issues with both of these candidates have, those are liabilities. And so it has to go beyond character because if you look at both of them, they cancel each other out. Hillary Clinton, more emails coming out showing that she was involved in potentially crooked, corrupt practices. Donald Trump being plagued with questions of character when it comes to women. And so you have to look at the policies that they'll put forward. There's got to be a distinction made between those tonight. There are distinctions. They have to be articulated. Also, the party platforms, which we spent a lot of time talking about. The both candidates are going to be, I think, wrapping themselves in their respective party platforms. Again, stark contrast between the two. And something that I don't know if it'll happen tonight, but I think it needs to happen, is that pointing to personnel. What type of people will occupy a Hillary Clinton administration? What kind of people will occupy a Donald Trump administration? I can assure you that those two would provide a sharp contrast. So I think those are the things that you're going to be looking at tonight is a way to show contrast between the two candidates beyond their personalities.
And I'm curious, tonight's debate is going to be hosted by Chris Wallace, I believe, from
Fox News.
There's been criticism from conservatives about some of the debate moderators not being fair and balanced, shall we say. Do you think that having Chris Wallace as the moderator will make a difference from the earlier debates?
You know, I mean, obviously it makes some difference. I think Chris Wallace is in a little bit of a different category. I think he's more of a seasoned journalist, kind of almost from the old school where they actually do journalism, you know, which is a novelty these days. But although I would say he's certainly not a conservative. I mean, I've been on his show and we've watched how he has treated conservatives. He's not really a conservative. And sometimes what happens when you have a, you know, quote unquote, a conservative news outlet that is hosting a debate such as this, they go overboard to show that they are fair and balanced. So we'll see. I certainly don't think it will be in anywhere near what we've seen in the last two, where the moderator decides to join into the debate and starts debating the candidates, which we've seen in the last two debates.
Now, I wanted to ask, I mean, you've given kind of laid out what you think would be the best thing for Donald Trump to do tonight. Do you have a concern that he has in some way maybe taken Hillary Clinton's bait or the liberals' bait by continuing to talk about the charges against him instead of just kind of moving on to the areas that are stronger ground for him?
I think there is some credibility to that assessment. You don't want to allow your opponent to shape the debate and the discussion. You know, if there are questions that are raised about you, you quickly say, look, it's not true, or it's true, I apologize. It's, you know, if in fact you do, and say, look, I'm sorry, that's not me anymore. And then move on to the issues and not continue to dwell on them. I think tonight he needs to, again, make the contrast between him and his policies. But I think, you know, in part, he doesn't need to spend a lot of time on it. But, you know, his, yesterday the president mocking Donald Trump for raising issues about how this election could be compromised, the integrity of it, when in fact the president's own Secretary of Homeland Security was raising issues in August, saying that they may have to federalize the election to some degree because of concerns that Russia may be trying to hack into our election system. Well, now we know, based on these emails that have been sent forth from WikiLeaks, that it was not Russian actors but bad political actors from the left that appear to be stealing the election, not just the WikiLeaks, but the O'Keefe videos that have been out today showing these Democratic operatives who are working to undermine the election and steal the election, something that's not new, in which they admit in the videos that this is something they've been doing for 50 years. This gives validity to his claims, but again, doesn't need to spend a lot of time on it, just the fact that it's happened, it's real, it's out there. Let's go on to the substantive issues, because what he needs conservatives to turn out and vote, because this election is clearly going to be determined by those that are, that motivate their supporters, or at least those who agree with them on policies, to turn out and vote.
Tony, this is Chris. I just want to ask you a question, because one of the things that's interesting about this debate, I remember when Reagan and Carter debated, I believe it was an enormously important debate, probably only, you know, second in importance to the original Kennedy-Nixon debate, or debates. But it was basically 2 days before the election. This one is, they're going to be something like 17, 18 full days before the election. I was wondering how you sort of see that as playing out, because that's something to consider, too. There's a lot of time left.
There is a lot of time left. And in politics, what I have learned in my 20 years involved is that a day is like a lifetime and a lifetime a day. Things can change so rapidly. And as we have this steady stream of emails coming from WikiLeaks, and there's more to come, there's supposedly 50,000 in total. We've not seen but about half of that. So, a lot more could be forthcoming. I think that's why you saw the Obama administration reportedly leaning on Ecuador to cut off the stream of these WikiLeaks emails. So, yeah, a lot could happen in the next almost 3 weeks before voters go to the polls and vote. But bear in mind, though, that there are a lot of people voting right now,
right,
across the country, early voting, absentee voting, and so forth.
Yeah, that's an interesting aspect of it that people, a lot of people may not be paying that much attention to, the fact that what used to be sort of, you had sort of the election was supposed to represent a contemporary consensus of what where people stood on election day, but that's really not the way it works anymore with so many people voting early. So,
Tony, I was wondering if you were Trump and you had to pick like three issues or four issues that were just your killer issues as you sort of see the election and how it's playing out, and you were just going to drill on those for the remaining 2 weeks, which is sort of the way I think he ought to do it, but he hasn't been doing it, what would you select?
Well, I think one would be the Supreme Court, because, again, there's not a clear contrast than that between the two candidates, clearly articulated by both where they stand on the Supreme Court. And that's not a hypothetical issue. It's a real issue, because the next president is going to nominate, we know, day one, a Supreme Court justice. So I think that should be an issue. I think national security, because we have been endangered under the policies of Barack Obama, and Hillary Clinton was a part of that administration. We've had attacks on our own soil. Those will continue. Our enemies no longer fear us. That's not going to change under Hillary Clinton. He needs to make that point. I think to connect with evangelicals, he needs to continue to make the issue of religious freedom a prominent issue, because especially given the fact in these emails from Hillary Clinton, their disdain for Catholics, conservative Catholics, and evangelicals. And then one other item I would throw in there, Chris, simply because of who Donald Trump is and where he is most comfortable dwelling, and that is on the economic issues, job creation, trade. I think though that also would be in the mix simply because he's well versed on that issue set.
Well, yeah, and I was going to mention on a couple of those issues, like the Supreme Court and religious freedom, especially that to emphasize that the conservative view is really the mainstream view on these issues. You know, people try to everybody wants to portray their opponent as extremist and so forth. But really, judicial activism is of the left is what's extreme. And the crackdown on our first freedom that the left is pursuing now, that's what's extreme. So, I mean, those issues, I think, give Trump an opportunity to portray himself as being the moderate, the one in the mainstream of historic American thought.
Without question. And I think because he has a deficit right now with social conservatives, evangelicals in particular. Although it was interesting to see Wayne Grudem today coming out with a piece, kind of walking back his withdrawal of his endorsement, basically saying, you know, I've thought through this and there is no other option. We've got to vote based on policy and platform. And so I think more evangelicals who are thoughtful in this process we'll realize that, hey, Donald Trump is the one who has embraced the issues we care about, the religious liberty. You know, he talks about the Johnson Amendment. That has to continue.
Right. Well, Tony, thanks so much for joining us, and we'll look forward to seeing you on TV this evening and I imagine giving more responses after the debate as well. So
that's Lou Dobbs at 7:30, right?
That's right. Guys, okay. Thanks for filling in. Appreciate it so much. Have a great afternoon.
Okay, you're
always
welcome.
Pleased to do it.
Take care. And next, we'll be talking about these O'Keefe videos. Tony alluded to that, about some of the dirty tricks undertaken by liberal Democratic operatives. We'll talk with Dan Gaynor from the Media Research Center after this break.
Are you feeling overwhelmed by the media telling you what to think? It is difficult to sort out what is true and what is false in the news. That's why Family Research Council President Tony Perkins writes a daily newsletter called The Washington Update. This daily email newsletter analyzes the most important events and topics at the forefront of the battles for religious liberty, the protection of life, and the defense of natural marriage, not only in Washington, but around the country. The Washington Update's daily articles cover a range of topics, from the latest election season news to underreported stories about both setbacks and successes in the fight for religious liberty, the sanctity of life, and marriage. Don't miss this critical, in-depth analysis of the day's most essential stories that are shaping our nation's future. Visit frc.org/Washington-update today to learn more and subscribe. Again, that's frc.org/Washington-update.
This November, faith, family, and freedom are on the ballot. After 8 years of President Obama, this election will mark the beginning of a new chapter in America. With hundreds of federal races and thousands of state and local contests, the results will determine the future of pro-life legislation, our ability to freely live out our religious beliefs, and who our next Supreme Court justices will be. That's why FRC Action is mounting the National Values Voter Bus Tour. Our bus tour is traveling the country and working with national and state groups to equip and mobilize values voters in battleground states and key races across the nation. As it travels the country, the Values Bus could be coming to a city near you. Join us in the effort for your values, your vote, your future. Visit valuesbustour.org for more information and to find a stop near you. That is valuesbustour.org. Hope to see you soon.
It's no secret that many members of the media are clueless where it comes to the essential role religion plays in our society. At a time when faith and religious liberty are the subject of much debate, this is a big cause for concern. This lack of understanding raises the question, can politics and current events be written about without the aid of religious context? Can the American media faithfully carry out its duty to tell the whole story if it does not grasp the rich culture of faith that surrounds its content? In an important talk, Michael Cromarty of the Ethics and Public Policy Center uses as his foundation the idea that there is hardly any story in the news today that is not somehow related to religion. Using his unique perspective on the American media's interaction with matters of faith, he also delves into the practical way in which his Faith Angle Forum is helping to bridge the media and religion divide. Visit frc.org/mediaandreligion to view this talk and many more. That's frc.org/mediaandreligion.
Welcome back to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I'm Peter Sprigg.
I'm Chris Gasek.
Filling in for Tony today, Tony is out in Las Vegas for the final presidential debate. We're going to talk next about a story that's been in the news over the last day or two involving new undercover videos. It seems that the left is always being exposed by undercover videos. We saw this last summer with the Planned Parenthood and so forth.
If Hillary wins, this will all become illegal. You can only do undercover videos against conservatives.
Right.
Yeah. They've done that in California for Planned Parenthood. They have the you can't tape us law.
But anyway, this is looking at some of the dirty tricks that are undertaken by liberal activists working for Hillary Clinton's election and for the Democratic candidates. And here to from James O'Keefe and his group, Project Veritas Action. And here to talk with us about that is Dan Gaynor, Vice President from Media Research Center. Dan, welcome to Washington Watch.
It's a pleasure. This is such an amazing story. It's at least it's good to talk about it somewhere since the media aren't.
Well, yeah. That's sort of a secondary issue to one issue is what is the actual content of the video, and a second issue. One reason we wanted you on was to talk about the fact that the so-called mainstream media is not really covering this. But give our listeners, if they're not familiar, just a little bit of an overview of what O'Keefe found on these videos.
What he found is an astonishing, actual, prideful plan to cause violence at Donald Trump rallies, where prominent people working for the Democratic campaign would talk about how they would send in people who are intended to wreak violence.
Right.
And
We have a clip. I think we have just a short clip from the video. That was the part of this story that jumped out at me the most as well. Can we play that clip right now?
Initiating the conflict by having leading conversations with people who are naturally psychotic.
Okay. So this is Scott Fovell, which is working for a group called Americans United for Change, I think it is.
Exactly.
And saying he was talking about their sort of hired operatives inciting the violence, deliberately inciting the violence at Trump rallies. And so that was what that clip was about. Tell us a bit more about that.
Well, when people, and the result, by the way, is that he's already gone, and he's been fired. Somebody else is resigned. This is rippling through the Democratic campaign, and you would think it would be a big thing because when you got somebody saying, verbatim, we're starting anarchy here, and proud of it. And then you add into that we just had a terror attack in North Carolina where a Republican HQ in North Carolina was firebombed. You've had repeated examples where the media have blamed Trump all through the campaign about violence at his events. This forces them to change the narrative, and they refuse. And when I say they refuse, they flat out have not covered it.
You know something? I hadn't thought about it until right now, but I think somebody who was at that Chicago rally or the San Jose rally who was injured might have a pretty good basis for starting up a class action suit against, I just named all the Democrats and, everyone involved from Clinton down to, these people, right? I mean, it's just like a RICO operation.
Well, it's because you just used the words I was going to use. You're reading my mind. How how on earth does this not qualify for RICO?
Wow, yeah, this really is.
When you have organized political terrorism.
Yeah.
Coming from one political campaign.
Yeah, these are gangsters.
I'll tell you how it doesn't happen.
Yeah. These are gangsters. This is like organized crime, right?
Well, and the irony is that they were creating a narrative that was exactly the opposite, the narrative that, it's Trump and his followers who are fomenting violence. But that was all sort of staged by the left, in a sense.
And it was the narrative that worked.
Right.
It's the narrative that took off all throughout the campaign that the media had been using around the clock, even when acts of violence would occur, even when there was very clear-cut acts of violence. We've had multiple people go after Trump. One guy got arrested doing so. Another guy wanted to assassinate him. You had in San Diego, one of the anti-Trump rioters tried to grab a gun from one of the police officers. And yet the media have consistently blamed Trump because that fits the narrative. It's like when George H.W. Bush ran for re-election and the economy was the big issue, and the economy had actually improved, but the media didn't tell us about it until after the election.
One of the things that now I'm recalling, especially the Chicago event and San Jose event, those two were incredibly shocking, and Chicago was really mind-boggling. And I remember something that really disappointed me in the actions of one of the other candidates who came out and Republican blaming Trump. And I was like, what are you doing? I mean, do you not realize these are basically leftist, Marxist, Alinskyite tactics? I mean, what are you thinking? And I think it was Ted Cruz.
I don't think it was Ted Cruz. It may have been Kasich.
Well, it's definitely. I remember the Chicago event where I think they shut down that event.
Right.
There was also a reference to one in Arizona where they closed the highway. Basically, the protesters closed the highway. Well, I wish we had more time to go over this, Dan, but this segment is just about gone. But thanks for joining us, talking about the latest videos showing dirty tricks by the Democrats in the campaign. We'll be right back after this break. Oh, we have 1 minute to go. Okay, I thought we only Well, there we go. Well, maybe we do have time. I was going to ask you about the voter fraud aspect of this because it was interesting when Republicans express concern about voter fraud. The Democrats say, nobody goes to the polls and pretends to be somebody else. But the kind of voter fraud they talk about on these tapes is voter registration fraud, registering people who are not entitled to vote. Did you pick up on that?
Also, remember, when Democrats complain about voter fraud, as they have done repeatedly for years, they talk about how the system is fixed. They remember the black box voting scandal with Diebold, where I was at my ATM today, and it's a Diebold ATM.
We got to run.
Yeah. We're going to have to.
We're getting a hard cut out.
Now our extra minute is
gone. Now we
gone,
do have to go.
Thanks.
Hold that thought, Dan.
Thanks for joining us, Dan Gaynor.
Every day, Christian values are being pushed out of the public square and out of public policy at an alarming rate. What can ordinary Christian citizens do to make their voices heard in an arena that is set on silencing them? FRC is here to help. Every week on the FRC blog, we will publish a question of the week that people like you are asking around the country, along with our answer. Send us a question you may have about how you can better live out your faith beyond the four walls of your church, or about any specific value that FRC continues to stand for, whether it be life, marriage and family, or religious liberty. Go to frc.org/contact and enter Question of the Week in the subject line for the chance to be published on our blog. Again, that's frc.org/contact and enter Question of the Week in the subject line. Thank you for standing with us.
One of the great freedoms that most Americans enjoy is the ability to get involved in political campaigns. But what about pastors? Unfortunately, due to a little-known amendment that was passed in 1954 at President Lyndon Johnson's urging, churches and other nonprofit organizations are prohibited from making statements for or against a candidate for public office if they want to remain tax-exempt. This is just one of the many problems with the Johnson Amendment. Not only does fear of IRS action put a chill on the free speech of pastors, it restrains other nonprofit organizations from participating in the debate of public policy in their area of expertise. In addition, the IRS only rarely enforces the Johnson Amendment, causing widespread confusion about what constitutes lawful political speech and what doesn't. For more information on how to amend the Johnson Amendment, visit frc.org/Johnson Amendment. That's frc.org/Johnson Amendment.
Welcome back to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. My name is Peter Sprigg.
Chris Gasek here,
and
Family Research Council persona.
And we're hosting in place of Tony today, as Tony is out in Las Vegas for the final presidential debate tonight. We've had a couple of we talked with Tony earlier, and we talked about these videos revealing Democratic dirty tricks in the election campaign. But we want to make sure people don't forget about some of the important religious liberty issues, including court cases that are going on. And we just had an event happen, or not a final resolution, but an interim decision in a court case in Iowa involving a situation where a government agency there suggested that churches might be considered public accommodations. And this raises serious questions for the application of non-discrimination laws and so forth to churches. Joining us to talk about that case is Christiana Holcomb, who is a counsel with the Alliance Defending Freedom. Christiana, I hope I'm pronouncing your name right. Welcome to Washington Watch.
It's great to be with you.
And just give our listeners a little bit of an update about what the origin of this case was.
Sure. Well, an unelected commission in the state of Iowa issued a brochure sometime back, we're not exactly sure when, but stating essentially that churches are public accommodations if they hold events that are open to the public that the commission views as secular. And one of the most astonishing examples the commission gave was even a church service, which could be interpreted as a worship service open to the public, could subject churches to these public accommodation non-discrimination laws. The practical implications of that meaning that churches would then have to censor their own teaching about human sexuality and biological sex, and then open up their sex-specific areas like restrooms and locker rooms and shower and changing facilities to members of the opposite biological sex. So it was an unprecedented overreach of it, and the first of its kind in the nation that we had ever seen.
Yeah, to me, I remember when I first read about that, it showed this sort of, you can tell that this was written by somebody who's never gone to church, frankly, because
or been a pastor.
Is this the same document that talked about an exception? Oh, if there's a bona fide religious purpose or something like that.
Yes, that's exactly right.
But the fact that because a worship service is open to the public. Well, of course. Perhaps they don't realize that all churches' worship services are open to the public. That's the whole idea, is to have them open to the public.
They aren't soliloquies, you mean?
Nobody checks your ID to make sure you have your church membership card to go into worship. We want people from the public to come because we want them to hear the gospel and come to faith in Christ.
That's exactly right. It's part of the exercise of faith for various churches across the nation. And so just the unprecedented government overreach and attempt to control not only the internal operations of the church, but even its very pulpit is just staggering.
So once this was exposed and this whole hullabaloo has happened, when you took them to federal court, how is this commission, I guess, are they being represented by like the Attorney General of Iowa or what's going on here? Because, haven't they backed off from this? Apparently not.
So we filed suit against not only the commission, but the Attorney General of Iowa, because he is also endowed with authority to enforce this law against churches. And what was so interesting to us was immediately the commission started to backpedal to the media, to the public. So they immediately recanted the brochure. They said, oh, goodness, we would never apply this law to churches. We didn't mean it quite like that. They issued a new brochure trying to clarify some things, but really they were just basic cosmetic changes, but still attempted to reserve to themselves the right to dictate to churches which activities were religious enough to merit exemption from the law and which activities were not. And that's clearly unacceptable. The government has no business making those types of determinations. So Alliance Defending Freedom pressed forward with the lawsuit. Churches across the state of Iowa need clarity on this issue. And what was interesting to us was that in their briefing, the state of Iowa did not back down whatsoever. Mm. They stood by their initial assessment that they could apply this public accommodation, non-discrimination law to churches and control not only what churches teach, but also how they operate.
So who is who is the Attorney General of Iowa?
Tom Miller.
Is he Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal?
You know, to be honest, I don't actually know the answer to that question, but he stood by the law, which I think is enough information for the listeners to know. I mean, it's certainly unacceptable. He should have decried it immediately and said, no, this is certainly not how the laws of our state will be enforced.
I just hope he's up for re-election this year.
So we pressed on with the lawsuit. We had a hearing in late August, and we were quite pleased with a result that we received from the judge just this past Friday, where she affirmed the religious freedom of churches, in essence. She said, look, government bureaucrats have no business trying to control the internal operations of churches. They are exempt from the law, and so we're very pleased with the clarity that she brought to this issue.
But now this was a they denied the state's motion to dismiss. So your case is given a go-ahead to go forward, but it's not a final decision, right? They also denied your request for a preliminary injunction.
That's exactly right, but I couldn't have been more delighted by the loss, to be frank. So the reason that she denied the motion for preliminary injunction was because she said, look, the law does not include churches as public accommodations. No state or federal jurisdiction in the nation has ever categorized churches as public accommodations. That's a win. That's wonderful.
Okay.
Secondarily, she said, you know, the religious exemption would apply to all of the conduct that our client wanted to engage in.
That's great. Well,
our
time's about up, Christiana, for this time block, but we appreciate you joining us for good news out of Iowa on religious liberty.
As an attorney in communist Romania, Virginia Prodan searched for the truth. When she finally found it in the most forbidden book, the Bible, she made it her mission to defend fellow followers of Jesus Christ against unjust persecution. For this, Virginia was kidnapped, beaten, tortured, and placed under house arrest, even coming within seconds of being executed by order of Nicolae Ceaușescu, the Romanian dictator. Virginia Prodan's extraordinary courage, her search for truth, and her defiance in the face of evil is the subject of a riveting talk that she delivered at FRC's headquarters in Washington, D.C., marking the release of her memoir, Saving My Assassin. Visit frc.org/Romania to listen to her account, as well as the disturbing parallels she sees between attacks on religious liberty in Romania during the 1980s and what is happening in America today. That's frc.org/Romania. Should our daughters and mothers be forced to serve in the military through selective service in a time of war? Should they be required to serve in units with men in primal conditions where privacy and personal hygiene are by nature out in the open, and where they are forced together in close proximity for long periods? The American military is about preparing for, fighting, and winning wars, and performing specific operations against threats to the security of our country and vital national interests, period. Anything that distracts from the achievement of these purposes should be jettisoned. This includes placing women into special operations forces or forward-based infantry positions, and including them in the selective service. For more information on the common sense needs of our men and women in uniform, visit frc.org/womeninthedraft. That's frc.org/womeninthedraft.
We all know what it feels like. We try to avoid it. Experts define it as an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience associated with actual or potential tissue damage, or describes in terms of such damage. What is it? It's pain. Did you realize that you probably started feeling pain at a very young age, or even before you were born? Scientific studies have increased our knowledge of life inside the womb. We now have strong evidence that unborn babies can feel pain by 20 weeks or earlier. At Family Research Council, we believe that all babies are worth protecting. We also hope that even those who don't share our pro-life commitment will listen to the medical community and support laws that protect the unborn child from cruel suffering. For more information, visit frc.org/fetal pain. That is frc.org/fetal pain.
And welcome back to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. My name is Peter Sprigg, here with my colleague, Chris Gasek.
Research Council.
I forgot to mention earlier that we do have guests in all four of our time blocks for this show, so we will not be taking your calls today. That's why you haven't heard me slowly and carefully reading the phone number.
Do the famous phone number readout. I was going to say, you know, we should have you just do it, but it would be confusing, so we can't do that.
Oh, excuse me. I'm going to let my colleague take over this last story.
So I just want to welcome our next guest, who is a writer at with Breitbart Media, and his name is John Hayward. John Hayward has written and worked at a number of different institutions in Washington and around the country. I think he's very, very talented, very intelligent, and he's here to talk about the claim that Russia is behind the WikiLeaks email revelations or email dumps. And hello, Mr. Hayward, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you very much for having me.
Hey, how you doing? I was wondering, could you just sort of give a little bit of a rundown of the sort of the overview of the WikiLeaks, what's happened and who's doing it, and sort of, I mean, in terms of, you know, Assange and those guys, and then what you think is a sort of underlying story, which is kind of fascinating.
Well, who's doing it is the source of much contention, and the administration is increasingly insistent that it's the Russians. As of the end of last week, pretty much every intelligence agency has asserted that the Russians are behind it, that they're either manipulating WikiLeaks directly or they're feeding them information. And maybe WikiLeaks doesn't even know that it's the Russians doing it, but it's all supposed to be coming from them. But this is all assertions. It's universal assertions, and the targets of the hacks have been saying it. John Podesta, who is Hillary Clinton's campaign chair, has explicitly said there's no doubt it's the Russians, it's absolutely certain, but no one has yet introduced any evidence whatsoever to prove that. And part of the problem with doing so is that even if that evidence existed, it might very well be classified at a level that would make it very difficult to reveal to the public without damaging intelligence experts.
Because this is something that I'm glad to I'm very skeptical that it's the Russians, and one of the, or at least to have this sort of stated so publicly, this it smells like a rat to me. And one of the things that I realize and I remember is that this government perpetrated a massive lie before an election 4 years ago on the American people regarding Benghazi. And they lied and they lied and they lied. And I don't think they've ever actually recanted. I mean, I don't even think they've ever backed off the, you know, the videotape story ever. And Obama, you know, maybe Clinton, I doubt that they ever have. And I'll tell you what was also very interesting. There's a book out by Jack Cashel on the TWA Flight 800 event. And, you know, just needless to say, I've always been sort of skeptical about that, but I've never really focused on it a great deal. But the capacity of our modern government to sort of lead us astray, especially when it's a Clinton government or you know someone like this involved, it's very interesting. And this Russian leak sort of fits too easily into a narrative. What do you think? I mean.
Well, I think that's true. I think another example that leaps to mind of a recent vintage is the sexing up of ISIS intelligence. Remember, this was maybe a year or two ago that this story started breaking, but it turned out that the intelligence reports about our struggle against ISIS in the Middle East had been falsified on a breathtaking scale. It was a gigantic interagency conspiracy that was doctoring all this information to make the administration look better. And when it came out, there was much anger and outrage from some of the lower-level people in the bureaucracies, but not much really changed. There wasn't a whole lot of pushback, not a lot of heads rolled after that happened. And whenever you hear another claim from the Obama administration, I can't help thinking, and I think everybody who's a student of them would, that they'll falsify anything. Everything is politicized with this bunch. The Justice Department was politicized to protect Hillary Clinton. We have constant examples of things being manipulated in order to protect the powerful and to protect the administration's interests. So it's not hard to believe at all that they would all start singing in unison that Russia is behind WikiLeaks without any evidence whatsoever. But on the other hand, as I said, even if there was evidence like that, I can see where career intelligence people would say, basically, you have to trust me. I can't show you the evidence. We would burn our human assets. We would reveal our spies that we have in Russia. We would reveal our hacking methods and our counterintelligence methods. So you just have to trust us. We've heard that again. The TWA 800 example is interesting. This goes back years, decades.
20 years.
All of history, I guess, for intelligence.
Right. And there, when you sort of go back and start unpeeling this thing, because the government told just a completely comical story about, you know, what actually happened in the crash, you know, and then you start to realize that the you know, all the sort of levels of falsification that seem to have taken place, it's almost like we need a truth commission to sort of go in and find out, you know, what actually happened and sort of tell people, well, we're not going to destroy you. Just tell us the truth and stop lying now. Right. But the capacity of the government seems infinite in the modern government to just, you know, create these sort of these webs of lies.
And even when you look at the nature of the evidence itself, truth is the big issue here. And I'm not aware of any significant argument with any of the WikiLeaks material. I've written quite a few posts on it. A lot of other people have covered it. The mainstream media has not. You don't know about this if you're watching ABC, CNN, CBS. They're hardly mentioning it at all. But if you read the articles that are being written in depth by people that are studying it, there's explosive stuff in here. There's just powerful claims being made, and none of it has been challenged. I'm aware of no significant challenge to its accuracy, not even an offhanded challenge. You don't really even hear Hillary Clinton or her people kind of offhandedly saying, oh, it's all fake. I mean, they're not even saying that. It's like they're admitting it's all real, and they're telling us ignore it pretty explicitly because this is Russian disinformation or Russian meddling. It's true, but don't listen to it because the Russians are behind it. And I would have thought going into this, that would be a very difficult argument to sell to people. But so far, the mainstream press has embargoed it effectively enough to where you're not really hearing about most of it.
Well, one of the things that strikes me as very interesting here is that the, you know, if you go back and listen to this narrative, it really does sort of fit into. I mean, the media is going to love this because they're all part of the team, right? They're sort of the Praetorian media. So,
What did you say? The Praetorian media?
Yeah, like the Praetorian Guard in Rome, right? They're there to defend Caesar, right? They're to attend the, you know, the sort of the kleptocracy.
Just have to explain, have to define that for some of our
listeners.
Oh,
I'm sorry, Yeah. It's been watching those old, you know, Ben-Hur movies. Anyway, so, but the thing that's interesting here is that I think just watching it, like recently we've had, like Senator Marco Rubio saying, well, you know, it's clear that the Russians are doing this and that Donald Trump shouldn't use any of this information. No one's, like you're saying, they haven't, the Democrats. And these are all private emails. This is not government stuff, right? This isn't, am I not mistaken that this is all sort of, you know, this is all from like Democratic National Committee documents, right? This isn't like the Benghazi documents that were government generated and destroyed, right?
Right, and John Podesta's emails and things of that sort, correspondence of that nature. And I think there's a point to be made there about how we don't want to be manipulated. But on the other hand, it's awfully selective to be concerned about where information is coming from. And I'll give you a very recent example that everybody should remember: Donald Trump's tax return. When Donald Trump's tax returns were stolen, which is a federal crime, and sent to the New York Times, nobody in the mainstream media cared at all where they came from. Nobody said, don't listen to it, don't pay attention to it, this is stolen data. All of this high dudgeon was nowhere in evidence. They picked those tax returns apart. They wrote 10,000 stories about them. Nobody was interested in not paying attention. And I have a bit of news for Senator Rubio. No matter how well-intentioned he might be in saying that we shouldn't be paying attention to it, they will not hesitate if those leaks are about him. If he's a presidential candidate in 2019 and some fishy Russian operation dredges up information on him, it's going to be front page 24/7, 365, every major network, and none of them will hesitate to report any of it. It would be absolute folly to think otherwise.
I just want to make one final point, and then Peter has some questions. There's a Supreme Court case about this, and it is the Pentagon Papers case, right? The Pentagon Papers were stolen classified documents, right? There, I actually had a four-volume set of them at one point. I lost them in a move. But thousands and thousands of papers that the New York Times published in its paper, right? And people read into the congressional record on the floor of the Senate. So this is just rather, I mean, this argument that you can't talk about it and, you know, it's stolen stuff, you know. I mean, it's just too laughable for words.
Well,
the Bush administration as well. The New York Times published information that was leaked during the Bush administration that was damaging the national security, and nobody cared. They didn't say, don't pay attention to this. It's leaked by somebody who stole it. They ran it. They ran a million stories about it. They didn't care.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, there may be dispute about the source of the leaks and so forth. I mean, that's an interesting question. But I don't see why that should dictate what we do with the information. The information is out. It's on the internet, for pity's sake. People can look it up themselves. It's not like if Donald Trump refrained from talking about it, that nobody would know about it. I mean, so it seems to me like the default position, if you are kind of neutral on the question of whether the Russians did it or not, is, well, let's not worry about who did it. Let's look at what the information is and get the word out about it.
Mr. Hayward, is there anything that in the leaks themselves that has struck you that, you know, it's just sort of like the eye-popping items that are, you know, of interest to you?
Well, I'm intrigued by some of the exposed speeches. We've had Hillary Clinton's speeches that she was paid all that money for. We finally know what she said in some of them after years of keeping them quiet. And a lot of them are very strikingly different from what she says in public, and especially what she was saying when she was trying to woo the Bernie Sanders voters and win over that crowd. And I think it pretty well illustrates that timing is everything in disclosure. If these speeches had been disclosed at the height of the Sanders campaign or at the beginning of the Democratic primary, who knows what it would have done to her. But now that some time has gone by, the information is aged. It has a half-life. It's like nuclear weapons material. At a certain point, it degrades to where it's not as damaging anymore. So it gets out there, and wow, you know, she told Goldman Sachs some totally different things than she says in her speeches, but it's not enough to blow her out of the water, so to speak. It would have done a lot more damage to her in the past. I think that stuff's interesting, and I'm fascinated by how many media people turn up in these leaked communications. This is one of the reasons the media doesn't want to cover it. They're in it. They're part of the story. Reporter after reporter, named reporters working for major publications, CNBC, Politico, that appear in these leaked emails as subservient operatives of the Democratic Party. There's no other way to describe it. They're going to these top-level Democrats into the Clinton campaign and saying, what can I do to help you? What else can I do? How can I slant my coverage? Would you please review this story of mine and tell me if it's okay, and I'll change it if you don't like it. I mean, there's time and time again you see that in these leaked emails, and that's a big part of the reason why the media as a group doesn't really want to talk about this. They're very uncomfortable with it because they're in it.
One point that you just made that I think is really fascinating. I have to go back to Rubio, and so, but you know, so even if you had a rule that I'm not going to talk about certain things because they're confidential, like the bigoted comments about Catholics or something, right? You know, that was in an email, and we can't talk about that. When you're talking about a speech that she gave to a room full of Goldman Sachs people for $250,000 or $500,000, and there are like 250 people in the room, I think that sort of that's a little different, right?
This is really a secret.
Yeah. It's only a secret from us. We're the only fools who don't. We're the dumbbells, right? That haven't been allowed to see this, right? So the scam is on us. So what they basically did is, if somebody just like leaked the, let's say it hadn't come, you know, just gotten one transcript from somebody about the speech that says, well, we should have my dream is open borders in the hemisphere. Well, I mean, what's, yeah, that's, I think, I mean, to have the sort of, you know, blanket position about what you would accept or not accept. I mean, I think it's actually
incredibly. And there's something kind of comical about how we never knew that, even though other people could have leaked it. I mean, in theory, as you said, there's hundreds of people listening to every one of these speeches. But for all these years, we've not had a single peep about what they were about, which tells me those people weren't paying very careful attention. Nobody remembered it well enough to leak it after the fact, so we had to wait for WikiLeaks.
Yeah, it's interesting, yeah. Where do you think the story goes from here on the WikiLeaks? Do you think that Assange is going to be bottled up? It sounds like he passed out like a dead man's key, and there are people all over, you know, who are now distributing the information. Or do you have any information about that? Because apparently the United States or someone is reputed to have tried to shut down the dissemination of these remaining documents.
Well, Ecuador actually cut his
right. I mean, the embassy itself, right.
And supposedly that was done under intense pressure from the U.S. State Department, although the State Department denies it. But, you know, I think a lot of people believe that's true. And I don't know that you can really suppress somebody that way. The Internet is a big place. There's a lot of places to hide in it. There's a lot of places to access it. I don't know that you could actually shut something like WikiLeaks down. And I've been kind of suspicious of them forever. I haven't changed my opinion of them. I don't like the idea that you have self-appointed information vigilantes that are going to decide who gets to keep secrets and who doesn't. And one of the reasons it makes me nervous is that they keep exposing the good guys. They keep going after the pluralistic democracies of the world, and that's who they hack and they disseminate. But you don't see them hacking Russia. You don't see them hacking China. You don't see them hacking North Korea, because, you know, they'll kill them. They're not going to mess with the people that they're either sympathetic to or that would take revenge upon them. So I see that creating an asymmetrical world where the worst actors are the only ones that can keep secrets. And that strikes me as very dangerous. But I think our governments need to be more transparent. We shouldn't have to wait for WikiLeaks to know some of these things. Our media should find it. Our government should tell us. Freedom of Information Act requests should not be stonewalled. That the Obama administration has mastered this black art of stonewalling FOIA requests for years, and nobody gets the information until it's too late to make a difference. We have to do better than that. We can't have people with secret servers that hide their email that belongs to us for years on end. And if we're more transparent, then there won't be as much for leakers to leak.
Well, I really thank you for bringing that to the fore, the kind of a big picture
right.
idea.
That was a
of
brilliant
should,
point, too,
of how we should view this.
Right, this sort of asymmetrical warfare aspect of it is a whole different conversation you could have. And that's a very interesting sort of issue to raise.
Yeah. And that we're not encouraging this kind of hacking or this kind of leak and so forth. Of course, the left was not so concerned about it when it was a transgender army soldier who was leaking information.
Right. When they,
but right. Anyway, thank you so much for joining us, John Hayward with Breitbart. And thank you all for joining us. I'm Peter Sprigg with my colleague Chris Gasek, saying goodbye for Washington Watch.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our new watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.